From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the state of California, where voters considered an option to recall their governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom. The recall had gathered steam in the wake of Newsom ignoring some of his own COVID rules and dining maskless at a swanky party at one of the most expensive restaurants in the world, the French Laundry. Republicans saw a chance to paint Newsom as an elite who doesn't care about common citizens and makes his own rules. The Republican choice for governor was a talk radio host, Larry Elder. But the recall effort failed. Newsom prevailed in rather dominant fashion, strong enough for an early projection that he will remain governor. So what does this mean for Democrats nationally? What does this mean for Republicans who are hoping to carve into Democratic strongholds like California? And can we draw any conclusions about pandemic management? At this point in the pandemic, it's clear that southern, redder states prefer far fewer restrictions and are willing to tolerate much higher totals of death and hospitalization. In the New York Times this morning, David Leonhardt writes, quote, "In the run-up to yesterday's recall election in California, both Governor Gavin Newsom and his critics framed it as a judgment on his handling of the pandemic. Newsom embraced his enactment of aggressive mask and vaccine mandates. His leading Republican opponent, Larry Elder, promised to cancel those mandates before drinking his first cup of tea on his first day in office," end quote. As Leonhardt's colleagues report, vaccination rates have risen high enough in much of California, and the Delta variant is contagious enough among the unvaccinated that the state now looks very different from much of the Southeast and Mountain West, where hundreds of people are dying each day and hospitals are running out of room. In California, COVID caseloads and hospitalizations, which were already well below the national average, have been falling for about 2 weeks. So what do we learn about all of this, this recall election that got so much national attention? What does this tell us about the state of our politics, if anything? What did the polls say? How accurate were they? What's the data tell us? Our guests this hour include Joseph Burgess, who is a data curator at the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University. Joseph always appears on his own, not necessarily representing his employer, and we welcome him back to the program. Hi, Joseph.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is the most socialization I get during the pandemic. So,
don't make me laugh at that, please. And Paul Hippolyte is founder of Leading With Our Values, a public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me again. It's a pleasure.
Paul, what's the big headline for you coming out of California today?
I think the hot take is that Gavin Newsom ran against Trump and won, and that you can't beat a somebody with nobody. I think Larry Elder was just such an awful opponent, and the Democrats and Gavin Newsom's team deciding to run against Larry Elder and make it really about him as the alternative really worked. And there's something that Larry Elder kept on saying during the campaign, which was that all of these Democrats coming out in support of Gavin Newsom, but none of them are saying he's doing a good job. And it was clear that they tried to not make this campaign about Gavin Newsom and the job he's doing, but about Trumpism and how awful Larry Elder is. And so I don't know if there's as much good news as the end numbers as the numbers of the no on recall suggest.
Okay, so similar to a message of, hey, you may not love this candidate, but do you really want the alternative? That's kind of that was kind of the message, Paul.
That was the message, absolutely. I mean, and this guy, I mean, I'm sure we can get into it later, but some of the things that he has said, both said in this campaign, but has said in the past. I mean, just they're so outlandish that I think even for maybe some moderate Republicans or moderate voters in California that may have wanted to explore something else, this clearly was not going to be the option. I think at one point he said that he doesn't believe in maternity leave or any kind of abortion rights, and he thought that slave owners should get reparations. I mean, he's offering things to the white supremacists that they're not even asking for at this point. The guy was just so off his rocker that it was a good choice to run against him.
Hmm. Joseph Burgess, Gavin Newsom slightly outperformed, or from your read on the data so far, he came close to his 2018 performance. So first of all, what do we infer from that?
Sure. I think the main thing we could take away from this is that his strategy was a success. And especially if we're comparing it to the last recall in California, which brought us Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. I can never pronounce it. You know, the famous movie star one.
Arnold.
You got me. Yeah, that one. So they took a lot of lessons from the last recall and what the Democrats might have done wrong at the time. And they took that and really applied that. And the main thing was making sure there was no other replacement realistic Democrat on the ballot. So it could become this sort of one-on-one contest almost. That's what they wanted from the beginning, Gavin Newsom's team. And they really put that in action, made it work. And he's either going to slightly overperform his 2018 result or come very close to it. So I think he had a strategy. He successfully executed it. There were doubts, especially when the polling was not as good a few months ago, but it seems to have worked out successfully in his favor.
Now, recall elections are sort of strange animals on their own here. And, you know, Larry Elder was saying as recently as 2 weeks ago that he thought they would have this thing wrapped up on recall election night, that they wouldn't need to be counting for the next day or two or three, that the momentum was so hard against this elite governor. I mean, of course, that's his own propaganda, but he was way wrong. How did the polls do on this one, Joseph?
They did pretty well. So I think people were looking at a few months ago, the polls had Newsom maybe even almost tied or with like a single digit lead. And I think that really shocked a lot of people into action. And then the polls, as we got closer, the last month or so especially, had Newsom with about a 20-point lead, which is very close to what he's going to end up with. So if we're talking about polling continuing to make mistakes or misfires, that's not the case here. The end result of polling is going to be very close to the actual result.
Okay. And in a 20-point win, comfortable win for Gavin Newsom, Paul Hippolyte, I mean, I take the point that the Republicans ran someone who kind of beclowned himself and didn't really endear himself to the center or people who might, I don't even know what the center is, but people who might be sort of willing to take a second look there. But I do think that there is something powerful beyond just a propaganda narrative. I think there is something powerful when voters see political leaders who don't play by the same rules they do. So, yes, Gavin Newsom just went out to dinner at the French Laundry, but this was the dude telling people not to do that. This was the guy telling people, stay home, save lives. He was telling people, don't be indoors with other people unmasked. In the same way that Andrew Cuomo was telling people, be patient, we'll get tests, you know, eventually. And meanwhile, he was arranging for private test shipments to go to his family, for all kinds of, you know, sweet deals for people close to him. That stuff really lands with people. And I guess I'm surprised that Republicans didn't do better or figure out how to do better, because that narrative is strong. But that, even if it was one dinner with Gavin Newsom, that was a strong image. And I'm curious to know what you make of that.
I absolutely agree. I think that the Democrats are, I mean, Joe Biden's numbers are slipping. There are a number of Democratic leaders across the country that their numbers are slipping. And I think next year could be another shellacking kind of a year. If there's a cautionary tale for the Republicans, it's, and you asked earlier about the headline, it's Trumpism is still running the Republican Party. And I think even unfortunately for the Republicans, in a lot of these swing states, I mean, this is going to matter so much more than I think the Democrats' goal will be to scare them, to scare suburban college educated voters away from the Republicans with characters like Larry Elder. In Ohio right now, you have the U.S. Senator Rob Portman is retiring, and the three Republican contenders to replace him are trying to figure out how they can out-Trump the other. You have what Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, who was going to be up for re-election. He made a sharp turn to the right, to Trumpism. I mean, saying nutty things about January 6th and the insurrectionists and whatnot. And then in Georgia, you have Raphael Warnock, who's running for re-election, and we're not sure. I mean, Trumpism is just rampant there. And so I think for the Republicans, like that's going to be the scare for them, which is, can they get decent candidates on the ballot, or is this going to be a bunch of Trumpers running all over the place, and the Democrats somehow avoiding the what we consider what happens basically every midterm election for a president, where they lose seats. This may not be as bad of a shellacking as we've seen in the past, because they just keep nominating just wackadoodles. Just I don't even have a term for them now. And then I think for the country as a whole, the cautionary tale is we are still, you still have a lot of folks in positions of power that are still questioning the integrity of our elections and claiming fraud even before an election is completed. And I think that kind of deterioration in the trust of institutions are going to have very, very severe consequences for us.
I'm going to come back to the issue of claims of fraud in a moment here, but let me just pursue one line of thinking that you're raising here, Paul. When you talk about whether it's the midterm elections, recall election in California, when you talk about Democrats running in a way, in sort of a strategic way to say to voters, look, you may not be thrilled with the status quo, or you may not be thrilled with us, but look at the alternative and tell me that's what you want. That may be powerful, but does that lead to sort of weaker or less effective governing? I mean, does that give a bit of a pass to Democrats who are not perhaps earning votes through good governance all the time? If that makes sense.
It does make sense. And not only is it giving them a pass, but it's a bad long-term strategy. It's an absolutely terrible strategy. So, but it does work in cases. So, I mean, I think one of the most famous ones is Senator Claire McCaskill out of Missouri, who I think back in 2010 ran against Todd Aiken. I almost said Clay Aiken, but a different
yes.
show.
Who
also ran for office, said, not to interrupt. But
Clay did run for office, yes.
Yeah, but the guy who said that if a woman is raped, if she's truly raped or whatever the line was, genuine rape or something like that, then her body will get rid of it. So she was able to last that election, but then the next round, when they found someone that had a military background that was a little bit more, came off as a little bit more moderate, she lost her seat handily. And so just because you hold on one round, it doesn't mean that you're safe. So you have to give the voters something to vote for. And right now, the Democrats are stumbling on a number of fronts. And whether it's infrastructure still being held up, the voting rights bill being held up, there's the economy hasn't bounced back as we would have expected at this point. And even Biden's latest push for the federal mandate on vaccines, I think a lot of that was just frustration from his left flank saying that he's not doing enough on that front. And people are tired and they want to get back to some semblance of normal, of normalcy. And we won't get there until we can get over this hump. And he just hasn't seemed to really want to turn up the heat to make sure that we can get back to normal. And I think that's, I think more than the Afghanistan situation, more than anything else, I think that's why his numbers are sagging. And if things don't turn around and we're still kind of in this semi-lockdown next year, I think it could be an awful year for Democrats.
Well, and so let me kick this over to Joseph Burgess. Just to clarify, when Paul Hippolyte points to Todd Aiken, who was a congressman who ran for Senate as a Republican, the actual quote was, if a woman's pregnant, and if it's a legitimate rape,
yeah, legitimate.
The female body has ways to shut that whole thing down. That was an actual quote from a sentient human being who served in Congress and ran for Senate. when those are your opponents, it's easy to sort of you know, say at least we're not that. But the question is, are you doing enough to earn votes through your governance? And Casey Hunt of CNN offered the following analysis that I will read for our guests. I'll start with Joseph on this. Casey Hunt of CNN says this is what we need to learn from the California recall governor election big picture. She writes, quote, "One of the top Democrats in the country got caught living like an elite where everyone else suffered. Elites versus the rest is the driving force in our politics right now, and Democrats have a tough needle to thread both in California and nationwide. Democrats need to prove they can govern for everybody. And if you look at California, it's not necessarily the best test case for national Democrats. See concerns about homelessness or crime, etc. Republicans not named Trump did learn that they had unrealized opportunities with working class voters, including Black and Latino voters, as they watched 2020 returns roll in. Obviously, California is a special place, but the fact that a Democratic national star in waiting faced a recall and then had to fight hard for it midway through the campaign does say a lot about the potential challenges Democrats face across the map, especially if President Biden can't demonstrate he's capable of getting the resurgent pandemic under control, has another competence crisis a la Afghanistan, can't get his budget plan through Congress, etc." End quote. That's Casey Hunt of CNN. Joseph Burgess, what do you make of that analysis?
Sure. I'll start with the one thing I agree with that I do think is very smart and worth talking about, which is I do think there's opportunities for Republicans to appeal to people of color that they haven't previously, whether that's California, whether that's the Miami Hispanics that they really cleaned up with, and other, especially men, young men of color. So I think she's right there. There will continue to be gains in that with those demographics in the future. As to her other point about sort of the hypocrisy of elites, I don't know if that we've really seen politicians really pay any sort of political price for their sort of acts of elitism or hypocrisy or whatever you want to call them. And even if you want to just use this one, as weird and unique of an election as it is, you know, at the end of the day, he didn't suffer from going out in the lockdown and going to this fancy French restaurant we're all talking about now. So you have to look at it like, well, what political price? He won. If anything, he has more of a mandate now saying, hey, the voters just did this. They approved of me again. He's stronger. He has $23 million in the bank. So I think he's in a pretty good position going forward. It's hard to say anyone has paid any political price for being sort of a hypocrite about coronavirus or the lockdown.
Yeah, I actually
can. Can I disagree on that?
Quickly? Oh, well, yeah, go ahead, Paul.
And the reason why I am disagreeing too is, and why I start off by saying that this was more about Larry Elder and Trumpism than Gavin Newsom. His approval ratings dipped significantly. I believe they're in the mid to low 50s right now, which don't sound that bad, but for a state that Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. You should expect the Democratic governor to have a slightly higher approval rating. And he's winning he won the recall with about, when everything's said and done, maybe 63-64%. And so the no on the recall was almost 10 points higher, if not more, than his actual approval ratings. So that's not a good sign. So he has not fully recovered from those missteps. I think those did cost him. And as from what I know of politicians, because I've worked for, and I'm sure you've worked for a few of them, we've both worked for a few of them, they don't like elections. They don't like primaries. They don't like challenges. They don't like running. It's a lot of work. I think it does cost him in the long run, as one of the rising stars in that state. And we'll see what it's going to look like in the next year if he has any significant challengers that pop up because they see him as weak. But I think the recall became about Trump and Larry Elder and not about Gavin Newsom.
Anything you want to add to that, Joseph, before we move to another topic here?
Yeah, I wanted to sort of connect it all and even talking about Todd Akin, talking about Larry Elder. So the reason that this infamous man who said these horrible things about rape and pregnancy ended up being the Republican nominee is the Democratic nominee for Senate, incumbent Senator Claire McCaskill, was even boosting ads to try and make this Republican win. And I think it's kind of similar in that Democrats want to be running against these sort of almost larger than life villains to really kind of paint a different portrait. And again, that's part of a deliberate strategy. It did not work with Trump, as we all remember. But I think it has worked in the past on some of these lower level elections, and it definitely paid off significantly here.
Well, and Joseph, you point to where Republicans feel like they've got room to really grow here. When they look at Texas, for example, they feel as much as Texas has been moving in a blue direction, Republicans feel like they can capture a growing percentage of Latino vote. When you look at Florida, they feel like the reason that they've been able to, you know, win Florida in the presidential election a couple of times recently and feel like they can start to build margins there is because, let me say, when I say Latino, I understand and it has been well documented that that term is probably too broad and it means different things in different places and it's maybe overly monolithic. So there are limitations to the term, which I take the point. But just using Republicans' own language, they feel like the Latino vote is a big growth opportunity for them in Texas, in Florida, in California, across the country. What does the data tell us there?
Definitely. Happy to jump into that. I'll take a much longer view first, which is to say a lot of Latinos, especially people who have been in this country a long time, I think are starting to identify more as multiracial, Latino or white, or even simply white. And of course, however they identify is up to them. But I think that's part of the shift we're seeing as well in sort of a cross and racial identification over time, this great process that is occurring and will continue to occur. So that's something to consider when you're thinking of these people. You know, even if you consider them Latino, they may not even at this point. After that, yes, there's certainly some possibilities for growth. We actually didn't really see that in California in either 2020 or in this election. It seems like Newsom held up in the Latino vote. It seems like he did pretty well with the Vietnamese vote in Orange County, which is crucial for a couple of congressional elections. But at the same time, there are these huge warning signs for Democrats in Texas, in Miami, some pretty important places politically. So I think we're watching this kind of shift happen over time. I'm not sure if the Democrats have the tools necessary to fix it, but in California, at least, they seem to be doing okay.
Okay. Paul Hippolyte, how do you not only feel about Republicans feeling like they've got a growth opportunity with, if we're going to talk about it monolithically, the Latino vote, but how do you also feel about people like Larry Elder, a black man who will talk often about how he feels that Democrats should stop just assuming that any voter who's not white will be with them and that Republicans have a real chance to make inroads there?
Let me start off by saying that my mom is from Panama, and I do consider myself Latino also, but there is a large percentage of the Latino community that are also white supremacists. There are plenty of white Latinos, and so seeing them, I think, as persons of color is a bit problematic in my view, as just as a whole, as that entire category. Mm-hmm. But even more specifically, there are racism is alive and well, bigotry is alive and well, colorism all throughout Latin America. And that's not a new phenomenon. This has been the reality for a very long time. And so because someone is in the U.S. that identifies as Latino and they're from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, I mean, go on and on, that does not mean they identify as a person of color. And it doesn't mean that they identify with a pluralistic, multiracial society. So the idea that Republicans have gains to make in that community, I think is a little bit overblown. I think in terms of the percentage of the Latino community that identifies with those ideologies, yes, they don't have gains to make. They already have them. They have them and whoever identifies like that. But in terms of people who identify as as people of color or darker skinned Latinos, and it gets very complicated there. But for the most part, the Latino community that does not identify as white are not. It still is overwhelmingly hard for the Republicans to reach out to them with the kind of messages that they have. There is a segment of the Latino community that is also very conservative religiously, kind of a little bit more in that authoritarian, male-driven culture and family makeup. And for those folks, like, yes, those are, again, I don't know if I would say those are gains that the Republican Party can make, because those people already vote Republican, and that's not going to change. But I think so many Latinos who live in urban areas, who live in cities, who are well-educated, who are a little bit more bought into the idea of a pluralistic society and multiracial society, I don't think that there's much gain to for the Republicans to make in those cases. So I think the fears are a little bit overblown when it comes to that. And as you said, it's very complicated. It's not a black and white issue.
Yeah. After we take this only break of the hour, I'm going to read some listener feedback on some of these subjects as we talk about lessons from the California governor recall election. What does the data tell us? And frankly, what do our guests think that we should be learning and can learn as not only in California, but nationally and for the major parties that want to try to cut into each other's margins in places? Where are the openings? What are they learning? And what is driving votes? We're talking to Paul Hippolyte, founder of Leading With Our Values, a public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice, and Joseph Burgess, a data curator at the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University. Here on this program today, just representing his own views. And we'll be right back with them and your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, an update on the housing market. Finally, signs of a slowdown in the Rochester region. We examine it. Then we talk with University of Rochester alum Xander Brown. She says her environmental humanities studies pointed her to her work in environmental justice, journalism, and advocacy, and it has led her to Flint, Michigan. An update from Flint Thursday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Charles is a conservative listener who writes to say, Evan, a few days ago, NPR ran a soundbite about how the only candidates that were left in the Boston mayoral race were people of color. The piece didn't really get into their qualifications or why their race and gender should factor into the decision at all. It just fawned over the fact that the candidates were not white men. So my main takeaway from the California recall is it's not about race at all. If the white men are leftists and their challengers are not, leftists will do everything, up to and including committing hate crimes against the challengers, to discredit and defeat them. It's no different than when the Democrats claimed they wanted a female presidential candidate right up until Tulsi Gabbard was the only woman candidate left. That's from Charles. Paul Hippolyte, what do you think? You're on mute, Paul.
Lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
I will start off by saying that this is an issue that it's difficult to dance around, but there is something that is just off about having a country or cities or states that have sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50% people of color or people who identify as some kind of racial minority, and in every case, a jurisdiction that is 50% plus made up of women, and to somehow see that the elected leadership over and over are almost always male, and and then almost always white males. Like, unless we believe that somehow that is the only group that has intelligence and leadership abilities and capabilities. And I mean, it's so obvious that something is off when you see that over and over. And so I think the idea that folks will celebrate diversification of the elected officials and in people in leadership positions, it's hard for me to construct an argument or to see what's the pushback or what's the fight around such an issue. I mean, for this gentleman, I would just say, like, just take a quick canvas of the mayors of every city around the U.S. of just look at the makeup, and I can guarantee you it's majority white male. So I think that as a country, we hopefully will get to the place where we can all root for that, where that different people of different backgrounds running for seats for elected office, that we could all cheer that on, whether or not we, even if we don't agree with their ideology or their party, just understanding that that's progress in a lot of ways. And I'm just going to leave it there. It's a lot of stammering.
No, it's okay. I mean, I know you're trying to sort of get your head around a lot of different themes there. I think Charles would say that he finds the political left to be obsessed with identity in its candidates. And yet, you know, it's perfectly willing to try to take out a Larry Elder or somebody else when those people of different identity backgrounds don't match their politics, which, I mean, I don't think it's that.
But that he's disagreeing with himself there. If it's only about identity, then wouldn't the left be all about Larry Elder over Gavin Newsom? Like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, if it's all about identity politics, then we, and by that they mean we only want people of color in office, well, then we should all galvanize behind a Larry Elder. Obviously, that's not the case. There's a lot more to having folks there in office than the color of their skin. But that being said, yes, some of us wish that the left or the progressives or the Democratic Party was actually obsessed with identity politics, because there are a lot of great candidates all over the place. I live in a city and that has nearly 9 million people and a very large racial minority. But every mayor, for some reason, just ends up being a white male. And this has been the case for the entirety of our history, with the exception of two people. The entirety of the history of New York City has been white males as mayors. And they've all been males, by the way. There's no way that we can, I think we can, if we're being honest with ourselves, think that there's no way that out of all of the women that have lived in New York City, that there's never been a good enough woman to be a woman good enough to be mayor. And even as governor right now of our state, Kathy Hochul became governor because of a scandal and because the governor was forced to resign. Beyond that, who knows when we would have had our first woman governor of New York State. I think it's hard to wrap my mind around why people wouldn't see that this is a problem. This is not a well-functioning society that operates this way. And so the idea of celebrating that we're at least tiptoeing near progress, it's very far from saying, like, we are obsessed with it and white males can't become, I don't know, governors of New York State. It's so far from reality that it is hard for me to wrap my head around a coherent argument, because it's a frustrating conversation to have.
Joseph Burgess, what do you think?
I think Paul said everything I think, but I will add some quick context, which just for Boston specifically, I was curious and I was pretty sure, but they also have until now only had white male mayors. So I think when you're talking even about the coverage of race, of course, it's important not just in how it informs the political identity of the candidates and of the demographics, but it's historic in this case. This will have most likely the first female person of color as a Boston mayor. And I do think that's worth coverage, worth noticing why that's happening, how that's happening, and these changes in our in who our candidates are.
I think tied up in Charles's email is an idea on the political right that the Democrats or the left will only nominate people who aren't white men, if possible, and they will do that to the detriment of qualified candidates. Paul, you seem to be saying that the evidence already flies in the face of that. But what should be sort of a good electoral strategy for the left going forward here to win elections and to govern effectively and to serve people well?
I may have misread or misunderstood the question, but I think there was a lot of conversations about race and gender identity and everything last year or during the last election cycle. And I guess that was last year. And there was a lot of hesitancy among, and this has been reported over and over, even among the Black community, with going with a woman or a person of color, understanding that we really wanted to get rid of Trump. And a lot of folks were very upfront that they were voting for Joe Biden because they thought that was a candidate that that a lot of white folks could vote for. And so that was, when you're talking about strategic decisions as to who we nominate or who we vote for in a primary, those things do come into play. And I think if Boston was a city where the Republicans were competing and were normally competing and where there was a threat of whether or not the Democratic nominee could win, I don't know if they would have gotten a woman mayor or a person of color as a Democratic nominee. So I think that's really the test case as to how far we're coming. When there's a competitive election in terms of Democrats and Republicans, when things are really, when we have the chance of potentially losing that seat altogether, who do we nominate in those cases? And I would say that almost all the time in those situations, there are white men that are put in place or the nominees. And so this is a problem. I think we've talked about this before, Evan, and my apologies if we haven't, but this is part of the problem of the winner take all system. So you have other like parliamentary systems mm-hmm. where in the UK and in the Labour Party, they reserve X amount of seats for women, for racial minorities. This is something that happens in India. There are other ways of setting up our democratic systems where we can build in a more representative elected leadership. We have not done that in the U.S. And so because of the system we have, it's really up to the voters and our parties to try to push for change where they can. But what ends up happening is that instead of having a party that is obsessed with race, the truth is that we just have a party that's obsessed with winning, and race or gender identity or a better representation is always going to be secondary to, are we going to win?
You want to
go ahead.
No. I mean, look, I think that there is plenty of evidence that whatever conversation about identity and race, gender, et cetera, is happening in politics, that there is still plenty of room as Joe Biden sort of offers as evidence that the Democratic Party still wants to win and recognizes what it feels voters are comfortable with. And sometimes that's a hard reality. But Joseph Burgess, is there more you want to add to that?
I mean, I was just about to say it. The Democratic Party just nominated Joe Biden. And the most diverse candidate field for the Democratic presidential nomination ever, most likely, they went with him. And I think that's proof of everything Paul was saying. I think we're in total alignment that it's a party focused on winning and maybe even to the detriment of having sort of these identity-based metrics to promote candidates. And one thing I do want to kind of highlight that's interesting to me is that the sort of rising far left, or whatever you call it, leftist movement in the country does seem to be represented by not this sort of white, straight, male classic figure, or even if you want to think of Bernie, but the rising leaders are, you know, the squad. Even on a local level, it's women of color who are leading the left movement in Rochester. So there's a real change in kind of how we're perceiving that and how these movements maybe are trying to recruit candidates and promote candidates.
Well, and let's just talk a little bit about the squad, just because Joseph brings it up. And everybody wanted to freak out this week when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wore a dress to the Met Gala that said tax the rich. And her point that she said afterwards, Paul Hippolyte, was everybody is talking about it, which means everybody is talking about the idea of taxing the rich, which means she was effective at driving conversation there. Do you agree with her?
Yes. That's easy. and for the folks clutching their pearls, it did not say eat the rich. It said tax the rich. That's as light as it can go. And by the way, the majority of Americans agree that we should tax the rich at a higher rate than we're doing right now.
I was confused by the people who were saying, wait, the rich already pay taxes. Obviously, her message is tax them more. Tax the rich more. Tax them more consistently and heavier. And Paul, you're saying that's a message that wins. But on the political right, even among voters who are not wealthy, they seem to view that as anathema to American values. What do you make of that, Paul?
I think that even on the right, a majority of folks do believe that people should be taxed, that a billionaire should not be taxed at a lower rate than their secretaries. I think there's a level of unfairness that's built into the tax code and how the very wealthy maintain and grow their wealth right now. And that's an entire segment that we can get into. But I think there's an inherent unfairness built into the system that that a lot of folks know about. And so that's the when you talk about it in those terms, people understand and they are largely in agreement. And to the small percentage of people who are believing that they're one good QAnon idea away from being a billionaire, I can't do much to help them.
Do you think then, Paul, that despite this being an issue that polls pretty well on both sides of the political aisle, if it's AOC delivering the message, then the culture wars take over?
Yes. Everything that she touches right now is fodder for the culture war. But I don't think it makes it any less effective. And I think as it pertains to having an impact and influence on the conversation, despite her antics, despite what people may say, that she's too far left or she's whatever. I think it's hard to argue that she's not one of the most successful politicians that we've ever seen. Her ability to control and to change the conversation and to direct and influence the conversation and actual legislation is just astounding to watch.
Joseph Burgess, what do you think?
I wanted to jump in on the popularity of it, and I do agree completely. You're going to hear that a lot. Paul and I agree completely. But yes, it's very popular, taxing the rich, basically among even most income levels, most races, most even by party. It's relatively popular among Republicans and incredibly popular among Democrats. And I also wanted to show just kind of one example of how that works in practice, which is, I don't know if most people remember this, but Donald Trump's most unpopular moment of his presidency by far was the 2017 tax bill when he was cutting taxes for the rich. So it's not all of these other flashpoint moments. it really came down to this kind of moment of economic populism, or lack thereof, where he was cutting taxes for the rich. And we did see that play out, not just in issue polling, but in his approval. And to me, that makes it sort of more real that we're seeing this play out in multiple ways. People really don't want tax cuts for the rich, and they do want tax hikes for the rich.
What Joe's describing there, by the way, listeners may remember, Congressman Tom Reed came on this program and defended that tax cut and said that, well, that the average person would get X amount. It was like $1,600 or something like that. That's after you factored in what the richest people got. So it'd be like if one person got $1,000 back and everybody else got a dollar back, claiming, well, that everybody averages $100 back. You know, you're going, well, no, most people are getting a dollar here. And I think Joseph is indicating that the polling and the public reaction to that indicates some level of understanding in the American public that that's how it actually played out. Is that fair, Joseph?
Absolutely. I think it was understood at the time as a sort of, maybe this is a little too dramatic, but a giveaway to the rich. Definitely seen as not favoring the average American family. And I think people really took that, understood it, and it factored into both their approval of the bill and their approval of Trump at the time.
Okay. Let me squeeze in a call from Rich in Rochester. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, sir.
Evan. Real quick, in looking at AOC, there's two reasons that she has been attacked harshly. Is it because she's a Hispanic woman, or is it that they see her potential on the national level in just her smart and just how good of a politician she is? Because from the day this lady has even started in the primaries, she has been a target of the National Republican Party, which blew my mind. She came out, she's coming out of New York City, wherever she's coming from. Some district, she ran, and from day one, they said, this woman's dangerous, or is it because she's Hispanic? And I just wonder what people's opinion is. Why is it that is it both of them, or is it one or the other? Because I never understood from the day she started running.
Why she's become a lightning rod?
Yes, from the second she started running, yeah. Even in the primaries, she's not in a lightning rod. I think lightning rod is only, yeah, I guess she's a lightning rod. And just real quick, I think even using the word antics for her, I think that feeds into this lightning rod thing. I don't think you use the term antics, because I don't think she pulls antics. So I just have to push back on that term.
Yeah.
You're feeding into it by saying it.
Okay. Yeah. Rich, thank you. I appreciate that. Paul Hippolyte, why is AOC such so polarizing, and why has she become such a target, especially on the political right?
I think she represents everything that some people are afraid of. So this young woman of color, very intelligent, and she's decidedly not in her place, as a lot of people see it. She replaced an older white gentleman who was in line to become the speaker. And instead, there's this young Latina woman who doesn't seem to be understanding what her place should be in society. And I think that she perfectly encapsulates what a lot of people fear about the new generation and what's coming next. And then to add to that, I think that she's done a very good job of figuring out different ways to get attention and then to use it to advance her message and her goals. So obviously, as we're talking about her dress the other night at the Met Gala, well done. That's not something that we expect from typical politicians. And so her ability to draw attention, but then to get her message across, it's just not something we've seen normally. So I think in our social media era, she's just constant fodder for the culture wars. She plays the role really well. And then on top of that, she does a really good job of getting the left and younger progressives galvanized behind her message and behind her tactics. So she's doing a great job.
Joseph Burgess. Let's let Joe jump in.
Yep. I think the proof of it is that we're talking about it. We weren't even planning necessarily on talking about her today, but we just, she's so good. And I think we've already kind of addressed the racial elements of why she's being targeted, but she's also so good at getting this attention, getting us to talk about her ideas that we can't stop. And I think that's a real power of hers, that she ends up being a part of the discourse. I wanted to very quickly serve to just sort of give my takeaway from the California election and other special elections that have kind of happened around the country, which is we're not seeing a dramatic underperformance like we did under Obama in the first 2 years for Democrats in these special and congressional elections. And that is kind of a point of hope for Biden and the Democrats, that it may not be sort of a historical midterm nightmare like every president has had for the past few presidencies. So there's this ongoing pattern, and it's interesting to see this continue to play out, where Democrats, even if they're not winning, or even if they are winning, they're not underperforming Biden significantly.
Yeah, interesting. And it, we'll close on this note. Paul Hippolyte, 20 seconds. David in Canada sends us a note that George Will announced this week that he's quitting the Republican Party because the party is not just Donald Trump, but it's Trumpism in every election. And he didn't think it would get to that point, and he can't stomach it anymore. Do you expect to see more of that, and what does that portend for the next year's elections?
I expect to see a lot more of that, and that is the headline that I had. If Trumpism is the Republican Party, watch out.
Yeah, we shall see, and boy, it's going to be an interesting next 14 months. It's been nice to not think all that much about politics, but can't get away from it forever. Paul Hippolyte, founder of Leading With Our Values. Tell people where to find your work online, Paul.
www.leadingwithourvalues.com. Thank you so much for having me on, Evan.
You
Thanks,
got it. Leadingwithourvalues.com. Joseph Burgess, data curator at the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at Cornell University, representing himself as always. Joseph, thanks for making time.
Thank you so much for having me. If you're interested, find me on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. All right, Joseph Burgess, Paul Hippolyte, and the whole gang here saying thanks for listening. We will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.